It's Something for Nothing, the Rush fan cast. Jerry and Steve with you. Jerry, I feel like I went to a Rush concert. Sort of.
Sort of. It was a very exciting night we had last night.
Yeah, it's November 14th when we're recording this, and last night we went to see My Effin' Life in Conversation, Geddy Lee, at the Beacon Theater.
With special interviewer Paul Rudd.
I was so happy when Paul Rudd walked out. We had heard a few minutes before the show that it could possibly be him, and it was him.
Yeah, it was a great choice.
Really good choice, mostly because he's a big fan, just like us.
Yeah, and it comes across that he's a big fan. And he's just a humble, nice guy. Funny.
Yeah. He's like one of us.
Yeah. Except he was named Sexiest Man Alive by People Magazine 1 year.
You weren't?
No, not yet. Not yet.
You know, that got me thinking, Jer. We're recording this the day after the first show. There's going to be a different guest interviewer for every single show. And there's going to be 14 shows.
That's right.
So who do you think some of the other guest interviewers are going to be, given that you know this first one?
I have the slightest idea. I couldn't even guess who was going to be the host last night. I have no idea. No guesses at all. Maybe the rest of the cast of I Love You, Man.
Jason Segel, maybe?
Jason Segel, Rashida Jones, a Leslie Mann, I think, is in it. Or the whole cast will just come out.
I don't know. Well, by the time people hear this, they're going to know a couple of the other names, but I have a couple of guesses.
Oh, okay.
Les Claypool.
Oh, yeah. Okay.
Right? Dave Grohl.
Oh.
Right?
Oh. If only we could find out ahead of time if Dave Grohl was going to be one of the interviews and we would go to that show.
It's got to be him for one of them, don't you think?
I just wish we'd find out beforehand. I want to go see that one.
All right. Well, he's from D.C., so I'm going to guess he's going to do the D.C. show. Chicago, I'm going to guess, is Billy Corgan.
Okay. I like that one.
Right?
Yeah, he's from Chicago, right? Just Smashing Pumpkins are from Chicago.
And Massey Hall, Alex Lifeson.
You think?
Oh, he has to pick Alex for one of them, don't you think?
Well, maybe we should go to that one, too.
Yeah, we should just go to all of them.
How many books do you think we can get?
14.
We'll get 14 books, right.
14 books. You can find us on Twitter or X, if you like to call it that. We're at Rush Fancast. Instagram, find us at TheRushCast. Email Jerry, TheRushCast@gmail.com. Find us on your favorite podcast app. The bass intro and outro, that was done by Lex. He was with us last night. The fans were happy to see him. The fans of Lex, I mean.
Everyone's happy to see Lex all the time.
Everyone is happy to see Lex. And you know what else we're happy about is your email, Jerry. Let's hear it.
Wow, that was a good one, Steve. This is from Mitch from California.
What's up, Mitch?
Fallbrook, California. I don't know where that is. Do you have any idea where Fallbrook, California is?
Fallbrook?
Yeah.
No idea.
No idea. Anyway, he says, I'm sure I'm joining tons of others in saying how thrilled I am to know that you two are back in business, at least temporarily. I miss you guys, but glad you've been able to have a life over the past 10 months or so. I initially was going to send you this email a while ago and tell you about my Danny Peart story, but then I listened to the episode where you interviewed Danny Peart, and that sort of changed my thoughts on how I'd approach this. In the podcast, Steve made the following comment.
Uh-oh.
You're being quoted. How do you recognize people who do a podcast? And I have to admit now how disappointed I am to learn that you two were also at the Peart Family Memorial Golf Tournament this year and that I didn't recognize you and I could have had the chance to converse with the two of you. I'm hoping you'll make a return visit to the event in 2024 so I can meet and spend some time with you both.
Well, it makes sense to me that he wouldn't recognize us, right?
You're surprised when anybody, as am I, when anybody recognizes us.
A couple of listeners approached us last night at the Beacon, and it was so nice to meet them, but I still don't get it.
We're fairly unremarkable looking people, but we're always glad to meet people who come up to us. So,
absolutely.
So come up to us if you like. So he continues, my wife and I had planned a trip to Toronto and Niagara Falls for September of 2022, and I happened to notice that the second annual Peart Family Memorial Golf Tournament was going to be held in Muskoka, Ontario at the same time we were going to be in Toronto. So I sent Nancy Peart an email telling her I was an avid golfer as well as a huge Rush fan and would love to play in the tournament if there was any room. She responded promptly, saying that she'd be happy to include me, and since I was a single player, she'd find a team for me to join. A few weeks later, she sends another email saying she's found a team for me and that I'd be playing with her brother, Danny.
Wow.
As you can imagine, I was thrilled beyond imagination. I'm going to be meeting and playing golf with the brother of my drum and rock hero. It was still several months away, but the anticipation and excitement was growing. Needless to say, I was a nervous wreck the night before and barely ate anything the morning of the tournament. The event happened to fall on Neil's birthday, so that certainly gave it an additional air of significance. Meeting Danny was an absolute thrill, and he was the nicest, kindest person you can imagine. The weather was nice for 9 holes or so, and then it absolutely dumped buckets of nonstop rain for the remainder of the round. Fortunately, no one in our group wanted to quit, and I had come all the way from California, and I'm playing with Danny Peart, so there's no way I was stopping. It could have been a hurricane or a blizzard for all I cared. After the event, Danny and I agreed to stay in touch and swap several emails. We also agreed that we would team up again for this year's tournament in the Niagara Falls area. Danny was a wonderful teammate again and just an overall great guy to spend the day with. I was so happy to hear that you guys were back and that Danny was your guest. And having met and spent time with him now on 2 occasions, it certainly helped my familiarity. And I'm sure, as with all of your listeners, I gleaned a lot more about his and Neil's lives thanks to the episode. Anyway, so glad to hear you guys are back, and thanks for the fabulous episode featuring my golf buddy. Best to you both, Mitch.
Thanks, Mitch. Sorry we didn't get to meet you at the golf tournament, and I'm very glad we didn't go to that first year, Joe, where it rained like crazy.
Oh, yeah, I would have given up immediately.
The weather was beautiful for year two, so we jumped on at just the right time.
Yeah.
So, Jer, I teased last week that we were going to have an incredible guest this week. And we certainly do. Our guest today is a British record producer who's produced some of the most iconic records in rock history, including Rush's 8 studio albums released between 1975 and 1982, Fly By Night, Caress of Steel, 2112, A Farewell to Kings, Hemispheres, Permanent Waves, Moving Pictures, and Signals. We are so honored to welcome to the Rush Fancast, Mr. Terry Brown. Terry, welcome.
Hello. Thank you.
We really appreciate you doing this. And we like to start out by asking our guest, Terry, their Rush origin story. And I would imagine yours will be fascinating. How were you first introduced to the band?
I was running a studio, actually the first 24-track studio in Canada. And I had a whole bunch of clients, and obviously word gets around. And SRO management, Vic Wilson, in fact, decided that it would be a good idea to have me involved in the record as a mixer. He basically called up, booked some time, and there we were.
And were you aware of the band before that? Have you heard any kind of buzz?
No, not at all. Not at all. Had no idea what to expect. I knew they'd recorded on the graveyard shift at a different studio. They had these 8-track tapes, and they weren't really sure what to do with them at that point. So I was asked to mix.
Were they having trouble mixing the album at that time, Terry? Is that why they brought you in, or they just needed someone to do it?
No, I don't imagine they were having trouble. I think they just, Vic and the management team just thought it would be a good idea to have me involved. So there you go.
And as a established producer, what did you think, you know, of the material from that first album as you were listening to it?
Well, two things. Established producer is a bit of a stretch. I had worked in England for a number of years and worked with some great artists, but not as producer, as engineer, or even I was doing a lot of tape hopping because I started out at Olympic and just learned the ropes. So when they came in, I was engineering, basically. I mean, I had done a little production. I don't really remember the timeline. It's a long time ago, but they came in. The objective was to mix, and apparently we needed to record a couple of songs. They didn't have enough material for the record, so we recorded "Finding My Way" and one of the other tunes, which escapes me right this second. So I sort of got into the producer's chair, but it was purely out of just the fact that it needed to be done, and we were there to mix this record, and so That's how it started.
And shortly after the debut album, Terry, Neil joined the band. How would you describe the mood in the Rush camp when Neil joined?
I wasn't really privy to the Rush camp, so to speak. I mean, I was running a studio, a successful studio. We were busy, and they called up and said they would like me to get involved as producer, and they had changed the lineup of the band, which at that point, really, I wasn't really aware of what was going on or why they changed the lineup of the band. So to me, it was like, oh, okay, sure. You know, different lineup, looking forward to it. I hadn't seen the band live at that point, so I didn't really know what to expect.
So how did you get involved then with Fly By Night?
Well, I think I can only imagine that they enjoyed themselves as much as I did finishing the first record for them, that they thought they'd give it a shot and I would co-produce their first record or their second record.
Now, were there any discussions, Terry, prior to the recording of Fly By Night about the direction, moving away from the blues rock that they had in the first record and going with a more progressive sound?
No, I don't remember. I mean, as I say, it's a long time ago, so I don't remember the specifics. As far as I remember, they had a bunch of material, and some of it was quite, you know, hearkened to the first record, I think. Best I Can. There was a couple of tunes on there which were similar in that respect. But then there was Bytor and the Snow Dog, and we were sort of moving into the new era, I guess you could call it. There weren't any really discussions. It was, here's the material. What do you think? I loved it. Let's make a record.
So you were a big fan of the direction they were going in with some of the longer songs?
Well, I wouldn't say a big fan. It was just sort of, I was surprised as to the material. I didn't know what the material was until we went into pre-production, which was all in the same 2 weeks that we recorded and mixed the album. But I was a big fan of the band. I mean, I loved making the first record, mixing the first record, and doing a couple of tunes with them and being very impressed with the way they recorded and the way they sounded and the way they played. I mean, it was pretty amazing, I thought.
So while you were recording the record, did you feel like you found something special in this band? Did you notice right away these guys are really special?
Oh, yeah. I mean, I had already decided that when I did the first record. I mean, they were special. There's no question about it. But then, of course, with the addition of Neil, it added a whole new dimension to it because, you know, he was writing lyrics and coming up with grooves and things which weren't there the first time. I mean, it was a good rock record, but then it went into the longer tunes and the more complicated riffs, and he was a big part of that.
And how is it working in the studio with that kind of those longer pieces like Bytor? Is it difficult, you know, to do a song with so many different parts to it?
Not really. I mean, they were well rehearsed. They knew what they were doing. I mean, and they were really good to work with in terms of making adjustments and editing, and you know, there wasn't any pushback. So it was a really great working relationship. So we could work really quickly and get things recorded well, and you know, it was a good working relationship and continued that way, I should add.
And speaking of that, Caress of Steel was recorded not too long after that, right? The next year?
That's right. I mean, I think we did 3 albums in 2 years at the outset. And they would, you know, they'd have a couple of weeks off or 3 weeks off or whatever, you know, in their heavy touring schedule. And they'd come in and we'd cut an album.
Back in the day when you could do that, right? Nobody's doing that these days.
No, I know. No, exactly. Well, it's changed dramatically. I mean, even in the latter years, we took a lot longer to make the records and a lot more care. 3 months, for instance, from start to finish, which was quite a jump from 2 weeks.
Did you feel just as good after the recording of Caress of Steel as you did after the recording of Fly By Night? Now, Caress of Steel didn't do as well. Were you surprised by that?
I don't know if I was surprised by that. I mean, it was definitely a left-hand turn when you think of Fly By Night. So I'm sure the fans were like, what? You know, but at the time, it didn't occur to me at the time. This was the material the boys came in with. And I loved it. I thought it was a great concept and felt we should pursue it. And plus, we had to deliver a record in the time they were off. So I was happy with the record. I thought it was great. I thought it was really exciting and really had some deep content. But it was obviously too much for the fans and too much for radio. And as we all know, it didn't do as well. Although, you know, I still get lots of fan mail about that record. Some people just love it. So it hasn't gone away.
We've met a lot of people who say that that's their favorite album.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah, me too. I know. Crazy, eh? But then, you know, it's that old story. You've got to be in the right place at the right time. And I think that wasn't the right time for that record. It was just too much too soon.
And do you remember, like, the label, their attitude toward the album, even before it was released?
Not really, because I didn't really get involved in the label aspect of things or management. I was in the studio 24/7 making records. So it was something that I didn't really get involved in. I was sorry to hear that it was a problem, but I don't think I really realized just how much of a problem it was until quite a lot later. Because, you know, it wasn't long before we were back in the studio recording 2112.
And speaking of 2112,
I knew you were going to say that.
The record company wanted Rush to go a little bit more mainstream, and they absolutely did not do that. Were you aware of that at all, or were you just like, hey, whatever you guys are doing, we're going to produce?
Yeah, I was aware of it, but it was something that I had sort of, I guess my style of production differs from a lot of other producers. I was really anxious that the band recorded and produced great music that they wanted to make. So to ask them specifically, hey guys, you know, this isn't going to work. We need some hits. And you guys have got to get serious and knuckle down. That just wasn't the right approach to me, because not only that, I loved the material they were writing. So I was kind of biased anyway. So for me, it was an exciting record to make. And I mean, right off the bat, you know, the synth opening of the first side, it's exciting. You know, it's like, oh, wow, this is really going somewhere already. So I was excited about it. And I think, and obviously the fans were too, as it turned out. So it was a bit of a risk taker, I guess. But, you know, that wasn't my gig. I wasn't there to be worrying about that. I wanted to make the best record we could. And I think we did. That's a pretty hot record.
Yeah, it's a pretty good record. Yeah. I would love to have been a fly on the wall to hear that for the first time. Like when that was presented to you, is like, hey, we got a song, and it starts. What did it start out like? You recorded it just like this is the beginning of the song.
Oh, you know what? It's so long ago, I can't remember the exact how it all went down. But I know Hugh Syme came in, and we had an arp. 100, I think. That's, again, hard to remember all the names of them. But he did a great job for that intro, and it really set the scene for the start of the album. And it was an exciting record to make. It really was. The guys were fired up. They played really, really well, and we managed to capture it.
The thing that always stood out to me in that song is in the section presentation where Getty's doing the back and forth between the protagonist and the priests, and his voice is so different between those two, and it's just incredible.
Well, he's a real pro. I mean, he was then, you know, he got the chops, and he was willing to go at it until he got the results that he wanted, which was, it's always been like that with Ged. He's, you know, he doesn't do things by halves, as you know.
Right. He's just pedal to the metal, right, the whole way.
Oh, absolutely. Yeah. Yeah.
Did you recognize the difference, Terry, between 2112 and, let's say, The Fountain of Lameth? Did you realize, hey, this is going to be big?
I'm not sure if I really understood that, but I felt that it should be a big record. I loved making it. It was exciting. I mean, from start to finish, it was like, wow, this is great. I was happy. And I always had this philosophy that if I liked it that much, there's got to be a few people out there who are going to agree with me. So, you know, it's a chance that you take.
And, you know, I think that Farewell to Kings was like a total left turn. I've said this to a bunch of people before, like from just the bombastic opening of 2112 to the opening of A Farewell to Kings. Can you talk a little bit about like the shift in, because that to me is a huge shift in style.
Yeah, to a degree. I mean, the opening of the album, of course, is acoustic. So yeah, that's a huge shift. But there's some heavy moments on it that harken back to 2112. But yeah, it was, again, it was one of those situations where we had, they'd already written a bunch of material. We started going through it at the studio, and it was like, you know what, this is all great material. Let's just get down to it and record it and make it as exciting as possible.
Are there any different production choices you make, Terry, when they change the sound like that?
I don't know. My production choices change, you know, depending on the day and then the artist and what have you. I mean, the opening to that album was recorded, Farewell to Kings was recorded outside, you know, and it seemed like the right thing to do at the time because it was like the Wandering Minstrels. And it was a beautiful day. I remember that distinctly. And we set up microphones outside. And of course, being outdoors, things sound different. So you don't have the concern of, you know, room acoustics and all that sort of stuff. So, yeah, it was great. I mean, it worked really well. And everyone got into the spirit of it, you know. We all had a great time doing that opening. I think it comes across on the disc.
I mean, it must be difficult, though, to try to control the sound when you're outside as opposed to inside a studio, right?
Well, actually, not really, because, you know, when you put a microphone in front of an acoustic guitar and the sound just dissipates completely. So you're hearing the guitar without any coloration of the room or surrounding, you know, chairs and, you know, microphone stands and everything. It's a great sound. Can't use it for everything, but it worked great for that intro.
Now, we've heard, Terry, that Rush recorded Xanadu in one take. Can you confirm that? And how did that go? Did you just say, hey, it's not going to get any better than this?
You know, I don't remember. So it would be unfair for me to say that, yes, we did. It's more than likely, because we would run things down for a number of hours and make sure that we got all the parts right. But I don't remember. I honestly don't remember.
But what kind of band records an 11-minute song in one take? Even if it was two or three takes. I mean, come on, that's great.
Oh no, well, we would do a number of takes, and we would edit if we needed to edit. We always started out with the band as a trio off the floor, and then we'd strip it back, and then we'd go in and we'd fine tune the bass and fine tune the guitars, and of course there were guitar overdubs. It wasn't like one guitar, so. And we did use different guitars for different colors and different amps. And, you know, so it was quite a long process. So we'd start with a fantastic drum track, which, you know, wasn't difficult with Neil. It was, you know, I mean, he was very, very particular about his parts, and we would make sure we got them the way he wanted them. And then we'd start adding the other instruments. But we'd start with the threesome, so it would sound like the right tune. Only, you know, detail-wise, we would take it to another level.
And in contrast to the story everyone's heard about Xanadu in one take, La Villa Strangiato did not happen that quickly.
I was gonna mention that, actually, so it's good that you brought that up. It didn't make sense to me to record that in one take. It was just so complicated. I mean, I don't have the chops that the boys had in terms of musically. So for me, it was like I had to digest a lot in order to absorb how we were going to approach these different parts. So one take for me, it was like mind-boggling. And they were familiar with it. So it was, for them, it wasn't so bad. But no, we did that in, I don't know how many parts we did it in. I tend to think it was about three parts.
In between, were they blowing on their fingers because it was just so hard to play, cooling themselves down?
Yeah, that was a great session, though. We had a lot of fun making that record.
The song Hemispheres, though, I had read that it was a little bit difficult with the vocals on that particular track. Was that true?
You would be correct.
What happened there?
It was extremely difficult. Well, it was one of those weird things, you know. We spent a month making Farewell to Kings. So we figured, well, we'll put a month into the studio and go back to Rockfield because we enjoyed it so much. And when we came out of Farewell to Kings, the night the limos picked us up, or the following morning, because we worked nights, we ended up, you know, it would get later and later and later, and we'd end up working all night and go to bed at like 7 o'clock in the morning. So by the time the limos came on Farewell to Kings, we'd done everything. We'd got the vocals done. Everything was complete. However, with Hemispheres, that wasn't the case. We tried a vocal on the last night, in the wee hours of the last night, and it was like, yeah, well, okay, we obviously need to work on this. So we get up to AdVision in London, which was scheduled for mixing time, and it became a vocal session. And it would had become quite obvious that everything was just a semitone higher than it should have been for Ged's range. And he was not happy about it. And so you are right. It was difficult. The vocals were difficult. But we put 2 weeks into them, and Ged worked his butt off and sang really, really well. I mean, obviously, evidence of the finished record. And yeah, but it was tough. Don't ask me how that happened. It slipped by us all.
2 weeks to record vocals. That, to me, sounds like banging your head against the wall for 2 weeks, right?
I don't know about that. I mean, I know some artists who take a year to record vocals on their albums. So 2 weeks is pretty concise, complicated material, and in a range that was a real stretch for Ged at the time. So I think we worked solidly every day. I mean, I'm amazed that he managed to keep up the pace, but he was bound and bent on doing it.
You mentioned you went back to Rockfield Studios for this record. What goes into the decision of, hey, let's go back to this studio, or let's try a different studio? Why'd you go back?
Well, we had a great time with Farewell to Kings at the studio there. And it's a residential studio, which is something that we continued to do thereafter. We never went into a regular studio after that, because being residential, you spend your time with the band. So you get up in the morning, you have some breakfast, you're talking about what last night's session, you know, so what are we going to do today? I think we should, you know, it's very democratic, and we go into the studio and we start recording, spend all day in the studio. We take a break for lunch and then dinner. And then, as I mentioned, we did work all night. So it sort of, the lunch and dinner thing didn't last very long. We were having dinner, which was our breakfast, and we were staying up all night and recording. But it's a great environment for recording. I loved it, and so did the band. It's not right for everybody. I've heard stories of some bands that, I think Asia were in Moran Heights at one point, and they just drove them absolutely batty, because, you know, you're in one place all the time with everybody, and not everybody can handle that. It depends on the makeup of the band and the chemistry.
And when you mean by residential, you mean there are living quarters.
Oh, yeah, yeah.
Either right attached to the studio or right next to the studio, right?
Absolutely, right next door. I mean, in the case of Rockfield, it was literally part of the building. So you didn't have far to go to crash. In Moran Heights, it was just a 5-minute walk or a 2-minute drive.
And because you guys got along so well, it worked out perfectly.
Yeah.
Yeah, it did. It was great. We had a lot of fun. I mean, you've heard the stories about the volleyball and the baseball and all those things.
Right. Midnight volleyball, right?
Oh, yeah. 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 And then some, usually 2 o'clock in the morning. I mean, our schedule, I like to start at 12 in lunchtime and then work through and take a break around 6 to 8 and then come back and work till 2 in the morning. So that was back then. That was the schedule. I don't do that now, but
I was going to say, you're still doing that?
No. I find that difficult. I'll still put in some long hours, but not quite the same.
So Permanent Waves was another stylistic left turn with a lot more shorter songs, and definitely songs with more radio airplay. Do you think it was important for the band to have some hits on this record, or did they not even think about that?
I don't think they thought about it in those terms. I mean, there was a sort of a development of their writing and playing skills, I think these things just happened organically. I don't think there were any major decisions. Oh, we've got to have a hit. I mean, who would have thought that Spirit of Radio would have been a hit? I mean, I did, but then I'm a total optimist. I mean, that riff off the top was like, wow, this has got to get on the radio. This is just too much for everybody to miss. But not a conscious thing, I don't think.
Yeah, it's hard enough to predict pop songs that people are specifically writing to be hits.
Yeah.
If they're going to be hits, never mind a song like Spirit of Radio.
Really? What a great tune, though.
Yeah, of course.
Absolutely, yeah. That was fun to make.
And another great tune on that record is Natural Science.
Yeah.
Did you know when you were recording that song that it was going to be the last really long-form song that Rush would do? Did they make that conscious decision?
They may have. They didn't make me privy to it. I mean, it was on that record. We made that record, but I wasn't really thinking about the next record at that point. You know, you get so involved in the now that was a great record. I love that tune.
And that was, you returned to the outside recording, right, for the beginning of that with the paddles in the water, right, for the beginning of that song?
Yeah, we did.
That must have been an interesting idea. How did you come up with that? Be like, hey, let's just go out to the lake and splash around for a while and see what happens.
Well, I always wanted to use the lake a little more than we did, to be honest with you. I had the crew set up Neil's kit, and you've probably seen photos of it on a floating raft, which freaked him right out. He was never happy with me for doing that. But honestly, the sound of those drums on the lake was phenomenal. I've never heard anything like it. And I was like so thrilled. I was like, I can't wait to get back and to record this, because I never did. But yeah, it was stunning. We would have had to have had a larger raft made, you know, a custom designed raft. So it was big enough that he would, because his stool was right on the back edge of that raft. I mean, I was so pleased that he did that, but he was like, he wasn't happy about it.
But after he heard the sound of it, was he happy then after he heard how great it sounded?
Yeah, I think we were all pretty happy with the way it sounded. It was phenomenal because the lake was nestled in this mount, these two, like, well, not mountains, but it was up in the Laurentians, which is a mountainous district. So there were these hills on each side of the lake were quite tall, and it just had this amazing echo that was, and of course the attack on the drums and then the reverb. I mean, you couldn't build that in the studio the same way. What an opening for an album.
I'm sure that the neighbors, are there neighbors around there? Are there people living nearby?
Not really, no. The whole area, that particular area, was the studio. And there was another, like, cabin and the house where everybody lived. But, yeah, it was all involved in the studio, so no neighbors.
Because I know from my house, the local high school is about a mile away. And every afternoon after school, I can hear the band rehearsing. So I can only imagine.
Oh, is that right?
Neil's drums. Yeah. Always hear that. If you have your windows open, all you hear is the band's drums. That's all you can hear. So I can imagine Neil playing on a lake must have been.
Yeah. I mean, I think if we had recorded a track out on the lake, we might have got some blowback. Who knows?
Now, next, Terry, you produced what is considered by many one of the top rock albums in history. In the top 100 in many lists, right? How does that make you feel, first of all, before we start talking about this record, Moving Pictures?
I don't know, really. I don't think about it that much. I mean, it's a great record. I still love it to this day. And it was a lot of fun to make. I don't get into that sort of stat thing so much.
Like all Rush fans do, though, right? They're always into.
Oh yeah. I don't know how I could react to that. Really, it's like when you're involved in something and it becomes a big hit. It's exciting and it's very rewarding. But there's an awful lot of good records out there.
Yeah, Moving Pictures though is, you know, always comes up we've talked to a lot of Rush fans.
Yeah, no, it does.
And obviously Moving Pictures is the tops.
I think part of it was the first digital album to be mixed for us. And I was pretty anxious to explore that digital thing because it was just starting to happen. And I was, you know, I'm sort of, I don't have that same feeling about half inch tape that so many producers talk about, the warmth and all that sort of stuff. As much as I like it, the warmth was on the 24 track, and I wanted to hear the kick drum and the bass coming back off the speakers on playback, the same as it was when I recorded it on the mix. So I wanted to give this digital thing a try, and for me, it was pretty wild. It was like, wow, that's what I've been looking for. So I think that made a difference.
Is that just the sound of it?
Yeah, just the sound of it. I mean, obviously, the thing that sold the record was the tunes and the performance, but that was part of the sound of it, was the digital mixing.
You know, there are a lot of records in the 80s that were recorded digitally that don't sound great, but Moving Pictures sounds incredible, incredible. What's the difference between that record and so many more records you hear in the 80s that just have that tinny sound? Why is that?
Well, it was at the start of the digital era. It was something totally new. You could get more top end, and the A to D's weren't really as good. I mean, now it's just phenomenal the way they sound. But back then, it wasn't always as good. So depending on what system you were using and how you were monitoring, it was easy to make mistakes. And it was like, oh, wow, this is like super bright and punchy. And some records turned out super bright and punchy, but didn't have any warmth at all.
How much did the studio have to do with the sound? You were back in the studio again for this record.
Oh, undoubtedly the studio was a big part of it. It was a great sounding room. Paul Northfield did a wonderful job recording that record. And they had a really nice Neve, a small Neve that we got all our drum sounds and some of the guitar sounds as well. And then we mixed on an SSL. So it was a great combination of great gear and really nice, nice machines too. An A800 Studer and an Atari, which we synced in order to do overdubs. It was really well equipped.
Now, is there any sense at all when you're recording an album like that, that it's going to be popular? Or, I mean, who could predict, right, that Tom Sawyer would be a mainstay, right, for the rest of their careers?
Oh, who knows? I mean, my feelings at the time was that it was going to be a huge hit. But, I mean, I've been wrong many times. So, you never really know. But I loved it. I thought this has to be. I mean, just right off the bat with that pedal note right off the top, you know what that tune is. You only have to hear like a second of it, and you know what you're listening to. That's an important thing when you hear the intro of a song, and you can tell exactly what you're listening to just by the first few seconds.
Did you have any involvement in the order of the songs on that record, or for that matter, any other record, or was that decided later on?
You know, I don't remember. I mean, I find that I order the tunes on most of the records I make, but I can't remember back that far and whether it was an important thing or not. I imagine I was very much involved in it, but I can't honestly remember. I mean, I do it all the time. I just sequenced an album for David Barrett, and it's an important part of how it sounds. We're going vinyl, so it's nice to be able to put it on, listen to it as a piece of art.
Right. So you're into the vinyl resurgence of the last few years then, right?
Absolutely. Yeah. Yeah. I don't do it a ton, but then I'm not doing a lot of new production these days, but when I can, I'd like to do vinyl as well as the digital thing, you know, the streaming. Obviously, that's an important part of it.
What about Exit Stage Left, Terry? That is widely considered to be Rush's greatest live album, and it also sounds fantastic. That came pretty much right after Moving Pictures. Can you talk a little bit about putting that album together?
Well, it was a nice change up. I think not doing another studio album immediately was smart, because that was a hard record to follow. So I think doing a live album was a really good move. And we had a lot of material that we recorded across Canada. And it was fun to do. It was some really good performances on it. And it was really nice to revisit some of those tunes, but on a live basis. It's good.
Yeah, I've always wondered about live albums like that span a tour. Are you like listening to every show when you're putting together a live album?
Yes, basically. Well, every show that was recorded, yes. Back in the day, because it was cassette tapes, so just like stack of cassette tapes, listening to everything and just trying to figure out which takes were the ones that were good enough to go on the record.
And that particular record, there were different songs from different shows on that record. It wasn't one complete show, correct?
That's correct. Unlike the 2-hour show on Moving Pictures box set, that's my favorite live record. But then, you know, it's a different, I have different equipment now that I can access in order to put stuff together. So I had a lot of fun doing that.
Now, going into Signals, how was your feeling about the album going into Signals as opposed to Moving Pictures?
I'm not sure about how my feelings were going into it. I remember in the studio, and you're all aware of the fact that there was some disagreements in the way we were approaching some of the tunes, but there was some good tunes on the record. And in retrospect, you know, from listening to it, as I've done a lot of in the last few months, it's a great record. I love that record. Subdivisions is a great starter.
Absolutely.
It has that same kind of vibe that on the Moving Pictures record. It opens up with a bang.
Yeah, instantly recognizable, right?
Exactly, yeah. Yeah, you know exactly what you're listening to. First chord.
Now, I've always read that New World Man was added at the very end, that you guys had like 3.5 minutes to fill for the record, and they just wrote that song in one day and recorded it in another day. Is that true?
Well, I do apologize. I don't remember.
It's a good story anyway, though.
It's a good story, yeah.
But that's Rush's only top 40 hit. That's pretty incredible.
Really?
It is.
Wow, I didn't even know that.
In the United States.
It was on Casey Kasem's top 40 countdown for a couple of weeks.
Amazing.
So you've been also involved in some of the 40th anniversary releases, right?
Yes.
Which ones did you start working on? Did you start working on, do you remember?
2112, I think. Oh, no. Farewell to Kings. That was the first one. I can't remember what I did on it at this point, but we did a little bit of mixing for that, and then 2112, and let me see, Hemispheres Nothing. We had no digitized tapes at all for Hemispheres, so unfortunately that one had to be left just as is, but some great artwork from Hugh, of course.
I'm always curious, though, about what it actually means to remaster something. Can you tell us what that means exactly?
Remastering is different from a box set. I mean, the box sets include all kinds of unreleased material. That's the idea anyway. And like with Moving Pictures box set, there was 2 hours of unreleased material. But remastering is really taking the original tapes and taking a new look at them with modern technology, or even just having them remastered by different individuals who have a different take on how it should sound. So remastering digitally, and then of course there's the vinyl. And the vinyl was done, some of those vinyls were done half speed metal. They were cut to metal and done at half speed. So they have a really good detail on them, unlike some of the other vinyls that have come out, remastered vinyls. So there's different ways of approaching it. But generally speaking, it's being remastered by a different individual. Like we went to Abbey Road and had a few of those records remastered, and they did a great job, and it just sounds a little different. You have to talk to the fans, really, because they're really clued in they listen to them, and you know, they'll tell you whether or not it was worth it. I mean, I've read negative and positive reviews about remastering.
You mentioned the live record that was included in the Moving Pictures 40th anniversary live in YYZ. And I agree with you. I think that sounds better than Exit Stage Left. Can you tell us about putting that together and what makes it so much better than Exit Stage Left?
Well, I think just having access to modern technology, digital technology. I've got a nice little studio with a Pro Tools set up and some nice outboard gear, and used properly, you can get really, really great results and be a little more specific about details. And the bottom end footprint can be changed a little more so than back in the day.
What is it like going back and revisiting all of these albums that you recorded, you know, back in the day?
It's been great. I've really enjoyed it. Yeah, it's quite very nostalgic, but also quite exciting, when especially when you get to do like that whole show I recorded in Toronto back in, what, 83, I think it was, for Moving Pictures. And so getting those tapes that had been digitized and then getting all the takes set up and mixing that was a real thrill. It was a lot of fun. Took a good amount of time, but it was well worth it.
Now, how closely did you work with Getty and Alex on putting the 40th anniversary together? Were you guys working together on that, or was it a separate thing?
I'm not involved in putting it together as such. I was involved in specifically mixing the tunes. Mm-hmm. And yes, we liaised regularly on that. I'd finish a tune, I'd send it to them both, and they would listen and critique. And I would then make some changes, and then we'd agree that it was ready for mastering. So we just went through all the different tunes, not necessarily one by one, but a few at a time. And they would be quite specific about their feelings on it. Yeah, it was good.
Now, I know, Terry, you said that you kind of weren't one to look back on your career in this way, but you've produced what is arguably one of the greatest runs of rock albums in rock history. How does that make you feel?
Co-produced. Let's clarify that. it was an amazing run. I mean, I had a blast doing it. And you're right, it's not often that somebody gets to be involved in 11 albums. It was great. I really enjoyed my time with them.
So what have you been up to recently? You said you have a studio in Toronto?
Yeah, I've got a mixing studio. Actually, no, it's up in the Muskokas. I have a place up there. And I recently had a mix studio downtown with my partner, Russ Mackey. And he ended up selling the building. So it was like, what are we going to do? Why don't we turn my walkout basement into a mix room? So we did. He did a wonderful job building it. It sounds stunning. And so I've been mixing all my stuff up there now for the last 6 months. And I've finished an album with Chris Herron from Tiles, which is a Detroit band, which I'm sure you're familiar with. And he had a lot of material that wasn't really suitable for Tiles. You know, as a band, they would go, I don't think so. But he's a great writer, so we put an album together. It's taken us 12 years to put this album together. But it's got a wonderful list of guests on it. I'm not going to give the game away because the record's coming out in the new year. But it's just a fabulous record. So that just got finished, actually. About 2 weeks ago, we sent it for mastering, and that's done now. And also, I've been working with David Barrett. I think I mentioned him earlier. He's a wonderful guitar player. He knows the Rush catalog better than I do. And we just put together a really great album with the David Barrett Trio, with Paul DeLong playing drums and Scott Matthews on bass and David playing all the guitars. And it's a very exciting instrumental record. Yeah, so those are the two things I've been involved in quite recently. And then Sepp Osley, who was the leader of Blurred Vision, which was one of my pet bands for the last 13 years, in fact, and we've never been able to get it off the ground. But he's gone solo, and we just finished an EP. And he launched it in London 2 weeks ago and launched it in Toronto last Friday. And yeah, it's getting some good exposure. And he's Iranian, so the material is, some of the material is leaning towards the more folky Iranian sound, and coupled with some heavy rock. It's good. Yeah, that's what I've been up to.
Well, Terry, I know we speak for all Rush fans when we say thank you for your incredible contributions to the Rush legacy. And thanks for joining us today on the Rush Fancast. We really appreciate it.
Well, thank you. It's been very enjoyable. Thank you.
So, Jer, what an incredible conversation that was. Terry was just as much a gentleman as I pictured that he would be.
Yeah, I was really looking forward to that for a while, and I'm so glad we were able to talk to him. Just another great guest who gave a lot of their time and energy to coming on the show. I appreciate it so much.
Now, there were a couple of points in the conversation where Terry couldn't remember Xanadu's recording or New World Man's recording. And I got to think about it after the conversation. It makes a lot of sense. Because think about it when you're at work, Jerry. You've been working for 40 years. Right. Terry's been working for 50 years. Do you remember any of the days that went swimmingly? No.
No, of course not.
You remember the days that were awful. Like, he remembers clearly the Hemisphere sessions because it was difficult.
That's right. That's right.
Recording Xanadu in one take? I don't remember that.
Yeah.
That was an easy day for him.
Right. He was like, oh, it's a, get to go out early to the pub or something.
And it was 40 years ago.
Well, yeah, that too.
Yeah. Do you remember a great day you had at work 40 years ago? I don't.
No, I don't. They were few and far between to begin with.
I think for us fans, a day like that stands out because we read about it and it sounds like such a cool thing. But this is Terry's job.
Right. It's not mundane, or run of the mill, but it's just his job.
Right.
Like you said.
Yeah. So it's perfectly understandable you forget something like that. And probably silly of us to ask.
Right. It's like asking, do you remember the pot of coffee you made?
Oh, man. So funny. Anyway, Terry was great, and we thank him so much for joining us. And before we go, Jer, we've got a lot of Geddy Lee news to talk about.
He's a busy guy.
So My Effin' Life, the book, came out this past Tuesday. He's got the tour, My Effin' Life in Conversation. And along with the book is an audio book. And Geddy and Alex are reading the audio book, which to me is incredible.
I know. I really want to find out which chapters or what part of the book Alex is going to read.
Yeah, I don't know. I've gotten about 3 chapters in. I've been going back and forth. I've been listening and reading. And so far, Geddy's read the first 3 chapters. So it's definitely after that.
I think it would be cool if every time he quoted Alex, Alex's voice just popped in.
Maybe he will. That'd be great.
That'd be great, right?
That would be fantastic. And along with the audiobook, Geddy has released 2 new songs that were recorded back when he and Ben Mink created My Favorite Headache.
That's right. He was talking about it, at the event. It sounded like Ben just found a tape or a couple of tapes with these songs on them, sent them to Geddy, and they were like, I guess, these sound really good. And they just cleaned them up from there. They didn't re-record them or anything.
Right.
That's pretty amazing.
Incredible. The 2 songs are called Gone and I Am You Are. And what I think we should do, Jer, on our next episode, we should play some excerpts from the songs and talk about them.
Yeah, okay. Talk about them and the book.
And the book, yes. A couple other Geddy Lee things. We're not done with the Geddy Lee news yet, Jer.
Right.
Geddy is auctioning off part of his incredible baseball memorabilia collection. Now, Geddy talked about at the show last night what an avid collector he is. And he has collected an incredible amount of baseball memorabilia over the years. And like Alex did with his guitars, Geddy's decided to auction off some of his baseball treats.
Yeah, Geddy described himself as a hoarder, actually. Do you know the comedian John Hodgman?
Yes.
He said the difference between a hoarder and a collector is presentation. And I think, Getty, you know, he has his things out because I've seen pictures of his baseball collection in his house and he has them out on display. So it's not really a hoarding situation.
Yeah. In 2008, he donated 200 baseballs to the Negro Leagues Museum in Kansas City. Those balls are still on display there.
200. That was only part of his collection.
Right. It was just the Negro League players that he donated to that museum. So now he's auctioning off 300 different pieces of memorabilia.
And some of those baseballs are expensive. I went to I think it's Christie's, is it?
Yeah. He's got a ball signed in 1965 by the Beatles.
Oh, I didn't see that one. You're kidding me.
He's got a baseball signed by the Beatles.
When they played Shea Stadium?
I guess so. How crazy is that?
How much is that going for?
I don't know.
Oh, my God.
He's also got a ball signed by JFK. He's got a 1927 bat that was used by Lou Gehrig.
What?
And a 1968 Henry Aaron jersey, among other things. And you can bid on these items now through December 7th. Christie's in New York City.
I'm shocked by the Beatles baseball. That's really one of a kind. I mean, having a baseball signed by, you know, Lou Gehrig or something, that's rare, right? But to have a baseball signed by the Beatles?
And all four of them.
All four of them? Come on. That's crazy.
But Pete Best did not sign it. So, I mean, come
on. That's right. That would have been great. If Getty had carried it around with him, waiting for Pete Best to show up somewhere.
And the other Getty news is he's got a new docuseries starting on December 5th on Paramount Plus. And we talked about this right before we started recording. It's called Getty Lee Asks, Are Bass Players Human Too?
I hope it's revealed in the show why it's called that, because it doesn't seem to make much sense. That's
well, the thing is, bass players are supposedly weird people, strange people. That's like the running joke in the bands, that the bass player is the weird guy.
The quiet one, the one who just sits in the back.
Right. Yeah.
Does his parts and has no life at all, that kind of thing.
Yeah, I think it's kind of a tongue-in-cheek kind of inside joke about bass players.
We should have asked Lex how he feels about the title.
We should. Lex knows all. The four episodes, Les Claypool of Primus, Robert Trujillo of Metallica, Chris Novoselic of Nirvana, and Melissa Auftermaer of Hole and Smashing Pumpkins.
That's right. I'm really looking forward to seeing Chris Novoselic. He is such a great bass player. I mean, he, in my mind, was really the linchpin for Nevermind. His bass playing on Nevermind is stellar.
Yeah, and people forget about him.
They forget about him. Some of those songs are bass-driven. They're like bass riffs.
Yeah.
And it's crazy.
And I don't know if you saw this in the back of the program from Getty's show last night. Getty is offering a free month of Paramount Plus with the promo code Getty Lee.
I didn't see that.
So if you don't have Paramount Plus, and if you didn't go to the show, we're telling you right now what the promo code is. One word, Getty Lee, all caps, free month of Paramount Plus. You can watch all four episodes and cancel it if you want to. Although Paramount Plus probably doesn't want us to say that, but hey.
Well, they're not a sponsor.
There you go.
So what?
There you go.
They lose.
So, Jared, next episode will be the final episode of our fall season.
Yeah, and maybe we'll do a spring season. I don't know. A few more episodes every once in a while.
Yeah, I mean, as the mood strikes us, why not?
Yeah, I was pleasantly surprised that so many people were still subscribing to our feed. It was really incredible. Almost no one stopped subscribing to the feed.
And we gained a lot more subscribers. So when Danny's episode dropped, we had way more listens than we normally did.
That's right. A lot more. Yeah.
Which really surprised me and really floored me. I'm just so happy about that.
I know. So am I. That we weren't forgotten, Steve. That's really that's really what's surprising.
So anyway, today is November 20th. Our next episode will drop on December 5th. That is 2 weeks from today. And the reason for that is we need to read this book. And I don't feel like reading it in a week, to be honest with you, Jer.
Yeah, it's a tome. It's a doorstop. This thing, you could prop something open with it. It's 500 pages.
And honestly, I don't want to rush through it. I want to take my time, read it from cover to cover, and then we'll talk about it.
Yeah, and you know, based on the excerpts that Getty read at the book event, it's going to be great.
Yeah, it's going to be terrific. So we'll talk about the book. We'll talk a little bit more about the show we saw. By that time, almost all the shows will be finished. So everyone who could have a chance to see it probably will have by then. And we'll talk about the songs too.
Yeah, great. Looking forward to it.
Then we'll wrap it up for the winter and maybe see you in the spring.
Yeah, when the flowers bloom, we'll be back.
You can find us on Twitter. We are at RushFanCast. Instagram, find us at TheRushCast. Email Jerry, TheRushCast@gmail.com. Find us on your favorite podcast app. Stay subscribed. You never know where we'll pop up. The bass intro and outro, that is Lex. And the quote, that is Jerry. What you got?
Just a quote from Vital Signs. Everybody got mixed feelings about the function and the form. Everybody got to deviate from the norm.
Thanks, Jer. See you in 2 weeks.
See ya.